on this edition for Saturday, March 21st. As the coronavirus spreads, hospitals and medical professionals are pushed to capacity. More cities shut down services.
Wanted to walk through the empty streets.
And how the music industry is dealing with corona cancellations. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us. If the top of our program looks a little different to you, it's because it is. I'm not sitting in the Tisch Studios tonight because all of us at NewsHour Weekend are practicing social distancing measures to decrease the spread of the coronavirus. I'm here at home with my family in front of a blank white wall. Let's see if we can change that up a little bit. All right. Our reporters, producers, and editors are working from their homes as well. So our broadcast is coming to you from many remote locations this weekend. When and where it's possible to gather news safely, we're trying. So far, our team is healthy and virus-free, but we know that might change. It's a new normal that we're all adjusting to, but there is still news to be shared. There are other things happening in the world. Often, they're also affected by the pandemic. But there are also stories of how we're adapting. So let's get to it. Tens of millions of Americans are now under strict stay-at-home orders this weekend as the number of coronavirus cases continues to rise. States and cities closed businesses and restricted non-essential travel in an effort to limit interactions and the spread of the virus. As of Friday afternoon, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported more than 15,000 confirmed cases and 201 deaths in the U.S. Hospitals warned they are running low on equipment and supplies. New testing facilities opened, but in some locations, people were turned away as thousands lined up. In Washington, D.C., members of the Senate and the administration continue to work on a $1 trillion financial aid bill. The legislation under consideration includes aid to industries, assistance to small businesses and healthcare facilities, and direct payments to individuals. The Senate plans to vote on the bill Monday. President Trump and members of the Coronavirus Task Force updated the nation from the White House this afternoon.
I worked very closely with Governor Cuomo, and this is the first time in our nation's history that a president's used the Stafford Act to declare a major disaster in response to a public health crisis. Never happened before. I'm considering other areas where we may or may not be doing that, and working very closely with Gavin Newsom, governor of California, and others. We may be doing the same thing depending on their needs, depending on what they're asking for. It's been unprecedented action in New York, and we've had a tremendous federal response all over the country. And I want to thank all the people in the federal government and obviously in the state governments and local governments. We are working hard. Everybody is working hard. And the people standing alongside of me are working very hard. That I can tell you. We've also reached agreements with Canada and Mexico on new travel rules at our northern and southern borders.
The global coronavirus pandemic is shutting down countries and imposing new containment measures worldwide. The Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center shows more than 280,000 cases and close to 12,000 deaths as of this morning. In Italy, where more than 4,000 people have died, police set up roadblocks today and more public spaces are closed. Today in Jordan, sirens signaled a new curfew. And in China, people were seen venturing outside in larger numbers. The country where the coronavirus outbreak began reported there were no new locally transmitted cases for the third consecutive day. South Korea's military said today that North Korea fired two short-range ballistic missiles into the sea early this morning. The move came one day after North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un was seen on state TV at an artillery competition. The South Korean government urged North Korea to halt all, quote, very inappropriate test firings while the world copes with a pandemic. North Korea has not publicly confirmed any cases of COVID-19, but its state media has said antivirus measures are a matter of national existence. London is not under lockdown, but Prime Minister Boris Johnson ordered schools, pubs, and other social venues to close, except for delivery and takeout. And people have been warned to stay indoors whenever possible. Joining us now, NPR's Frank Langfitt. Frank, what street do we find you on outside of London?
Well, I'm on the High Street. It's basically what we call the main street here in the United Kingdom, in a town called Weybridge. It's upstream on the Thames, about 16, 17 miles outside of London.
And what's it like there? I mean, I see traffic going by. I see pedestrians.
I'm a little surprised, Hari. I thought that more people would be inside. What's really interesting is that there are even some cafes here and maybe a restaurant or two that are not paying attention to what Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, said last night, which is he wants people, wants cafes, bars, and restaurants to close.
So how seriously are people taking this? Are there runs on stores?
Yeah, there are. In some places, they've been really stripped bare, and people have been kind of shocked by that. And there was a video recently by a nurse in the National Health Service who was crying. She's just gotten off a 48-hour shift and couldn't buy any fruits and vegetables. But the grocery store right down the street is not too bad. There was a security guard actually guarding the wine and beer, which is interesting. Most of the vegetable and fruit were gone, but there was meat. So it varies. One thing is that the supermarkets here are now saying they're going to hire more than 30,000 temporary workers to try to deal with the incredible demand.
What's going on with the overall economy? I mean, when people face school closures, they have to figure out who's going to stay home with the kids. What are the ripple effects there?
The ripple effects are really big. A lot, of course, most pubs and restaurants will shut down, I think, across the country, which will technically throw, I would imagine, hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people out of work. What the government has said yesterday is they're going to make an unprecedented effort. They're going to give employers who are willing to furlough their workers, they're going to give them enough money to pay up to 80% of workers' salaries for the next few months. And so what they're really, really concerned about here is, you know, the economy was not super before this happened. They don't want to see tons and tons of people thrown out of work.
This comes at a time when, well, Brexit is still part of the equation.
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of this year, and it's not clear, there may be another Brexit extension because this is an extraordinary situation. But at the end of this year, the United Kingdom was going to stop having its normal trading relationship with the EU. And there was no doubt that if that happened, that it would hurt this economy. I think now, given where we are, it's hard to imagine.
Tell me, just briefly, the importance of pubs. I mean, people here might say, well, so what? Bars are closed. But pubs perform a kind of a different function there.
They do. I mean, I'm a great fan of pubs, and they are a place where lots of people gather in the neighborhood. It's so much as a part of the culture, particularly after work on a weekday and certainly on a Friday night. And so to shut down pubs is a huge deal here, very different than just shutting down bars in America. They're very much a part of the social fabric and also, Hari, part of the British identity.
All right. NPR's Frank Langfitt joining us outside London. Thanks so much.
Happy to do it, Hari.
For more on what's happening in the U.S. and around the world, visit pbs.org/newshour. A recent model was developed to help hospitals forecast what they can expect as the cases of COVID-19 rise. I recently spoke with Annie Waldman, a reporter at ProPublica, about those findings. It's been a bit of an abstract idea that we don't have enough hospital beds. So how did you and your colleagues at ProPublica go about calculating this?
Yeah, so this was a question that we really wanted to answer. You know, how many, when coronavirus starts spreading across the United States, how will our hospital capacity actually be impacted? And so we decided to collaborate with Harvard's Global Health Institute and Dr. Ashish Jha, who had data looking at hospitals in regions across the United States and what would happen under three different scenarios of infection. 20% of the population getting the disease, 40%, 60% over three different time periods. And this enabled us to see which hospital regions would be the most stressed once coronavirus hits the country.
So on your site here, you've got kind of nine different maps. So really kind of upper left is the
the best case scenario, we only get 20% and it's over an 18-month period, right? So it's, the map mm-hmm. looks kind of green there. Things look pretty good. And then really in the opposite lower right corner, we see the worst case scenario, which is that we get 60% infection, and that's in 6 months. So even if we picked somewhere in the middle, we are still looking at lots of deep shades of red that is above 100% capacity.
Right. And that's the most frightening thing about these projections, is that even if you look at the best case scenario where the beds are, or where the infection rate is 20% over 18 months, our bed capacity will still be on average 95% full. That means in some regions, they'll need to double their beds or even triple their beds. In the best case scenario, where 40% of the population gets sick over 12 months, which would probably happen with the types of social distancing we're seeing today, we're still looking at having to double our capacity in hospital beds across the United States.
You've also got kind of a dialogue box right beneath there where people can just type in where they live. And then it's giving you kind of a bar graph of, again, with these different scenarios, and that's specific to the region that you're living in.
What we wanted to do was give the public an opportunity to look at their hospital system and see what the capacity would be like under these different scenarios. And what you find is that in some regions that are incredibly well-resourced, like Eastern Long Island, you will find that they will need to increase their capacity in a moderate scenario by 8 times, which means that they will have to either build beds, create field hospitals, or decrease the capacity that they currently have in the hospital.
Because it's not just about whether you live in a big city, because big cities also come with big populations, right? So really, your best bet might be kind of rural North Dakota if you can get to that hospital.
Well, there are caveats with that as well. You know, rural North Dakota, might also have the beds, but they won't necessarily have the expertise to handle the complex cases. So if you ask yourself, where would you rather be, North Dakota or Brooklyn during the coronavirus crisis? That's a good question. It kind of depends if you would rather have a bed that you can be in for sure, or a staff and that has the expertise to actually deal with these cases.
You know, given the information that we have been seeing come out of, especially Italy, where you see these doctors really just at their wit's end saying, I'm doing the best I can and our hospital is drowning. How are American hospitals preparing?
You know, we're seeing the news coming from China and Italy, and hospitals are trying so hard to create these plans to triage patients. There's going to be an influx of patients in the upcoming weeks. I've already been hearing from doctors that I've been speaking with that they've been expanding their capacity, trying to cancel all elective surgeries, open up other wings of the hospital. Some hospitals are thinking about how they can create hospital beds in untraditional places like cafeterias. And so, you know, I think that they're really trying to prep for the influx of patients that are going to come in, but they're also struggling with a lack of resources right now. So gloves are in shortage. Masks, we've heard about this, are in shortage. The CDC is now giving relatively softer standards for how doctors can prepare themselves. So we're seeing, essentially hospitals trying to prepare, but not necessarily being able to given what they have on hand right now.
What about the notion of having these comfort ships come offshore in different places?
I mean, we're going to need all the resources that we can take at this point. You know, it's not just about sailing those cruise ships into the Bay of Brooklyn or San Francisco. It's also about thinking about what kind of doctors around the world can we tap into? Can we rely on our Canadian friends, our friends in Mexico to help send doctors and nurses over to help increase our own capacity as we really take on this surge?
Annie, when you looked at the data and you've finally visualized all of it, what surprised you the most?
I think the thing that surprised me the most is just we have been talking about hospital capacity for a long time. You know, hospitals have been closing down. There have been, in rural areas, there have been mergers which have decreased hospital beds. And we really haven't been thinking about what would happen if a pandemic affected this country. What would happen if the 1918 flu were to strike now? And unfortunately, that lack of preparation has led us to where we are now. We are seeing something very similar to the early stages of the 1918 Spanish flu. And so we have to really think, you know, should we have been better prepared? And that's been the most surprising thing for me.
All right. Annie Wallman from ProPublica joining us from New Orleans tonight. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
under immense pressure, healthcare workers are bracing themselves for an expected deluge of coronavirus cases. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Carla Murthy spoke with Dr. Alexis Langsfield, who works in an emergency room at a New York City hospital, about her personal experience, not on behalf of the hospital.
Obviously, things are changing day by day, hour by hour. We're also seeing a lot of reports that there's just not enough protective equipment and safety equipment for healthcare workers.
There's absolutely not enough protective gear. They're ramping up supplies as fast as they possibly can. Even by the end of every shift, we're out of gowns, or we're out of bleach wipes. We're out of all of the things that we need in order to maintain a clean and sterile workplace. A lot of the emergency room does not have doors. You know, a lot of places that's open spaces with curtains in between, and those aren't places where it's safe to have people cohorted. So we're trying as fast as possible to actually divide the ER into multiple sections so that we can keep non-respiratory patients safe.
What are your biggest concerns in terms of keeping yourself safe and your family safe?
My biggest concerns are that now we're beginning to see that young people are getting sick too. The scariest thing here is that initially we thought that this was a disease of older people and people with pre-existing conditions. And as horrible as it sounds, I can handle that. But now that we're finding 30 and 40-year-olds that are coming down with it just as severely, just as quickly, just as fiercely, it's much scarier to try and protect myself. I'm afraid of not coming home to my kids and my husband, and I'm afraid of them getting it and me not being with them. And not being able to protect them. I'm in a situation now where I've decided that I'm going to pick up more shifts, and I'm dropping my family off outside of the city, and I'm going back into the city to pick up more shifts and work. When we made these decisions, it seemed like I still personally wouldn't be at much risk, but now we just don't know. So with the lack of personal protective equipment, and with the worst of the disease still to come, knowing that everything is, you know, we're just at the beginning of that steep incline. It's very scary. You know, I just don't know. I can tell them that I'm going to do the very best to protect myself, and that I have to do what has to be done because people need my help. But I can't really promise them it's all going to be okay.
And when you drop them off, do you know when you're going to see them again?
It's not really clear. Depending on how things go, if they close off the roads, if they change things, if I'm more needed, then it's really an indefinite stay. I will stay and work as long as I'm needed and can work. So if the population of needy patients picks up enough that I am needed round the clock in the hospital, I will stay.
The world of live performance is mostly shut down, like everything else right now, depriving audiences of pleasure and artists and those who work with them a way to make a living. NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker spoke with a number of performers and executives about how the music industry is responding to the coronavirus pandemic.
Okay.
As many of you have seen, some of the world's music superstars have been broadcasting performances from their homes. It started with Coldplay's Chris Martin on Monday, followed by John Legend on Tuesday, then came Death Cab for Cutie's Ben Gibbard.
I wanted to walk through the empty streets and feel something constant under my feet.
For fans of these stars, virtual concerts are the closest they will come to a live music performance in the foreseeable future. Like everything else, the music industry has ground to a near halt, with festivals and tours canceled across the world. And that has only increased the anxieties for the thousands who work in an industry that has only recently started to recover from a digital revolution that devalued recorded music and made live performance the only way most musicians can make a living.
I think at this point, we're not expecting any live shows to be happening across the States until maybe late June.
Zena White is a managing director of Partisan Records, a small independent label with offices in Brooklyn and London. One of their acts, the British band Idols, was featured last year on NewsHour Weekend. Idols were scheduled to tour South America this spring before heading to California's Coachella Festival in April. Both the tour and Coachella have been postponed.
Obviously, it's not just the band that this impacts.
Yeah, I mean, I think Idols have, they actually have been, as of this year, touring with a crew of, I think, up to 10 people on the bigger shows. So you have to think about that. Those are usually freelancers that ultimately they've got wives, families, husbands, and people back home to take care of. So there is definitely a knock-on effect.
Since the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak, Billboard magazine has been keeping a running list of the dramatic downturn in live performances. Everyone from the Rolling Stones to Alanis Morissette have either canceled or postponed their concerts. But for some, it started even before the coronavirus arrived in the United States.
We were supposed to go to China in April, and then other parts of Korea and Japan as well, so other parts of Southeast Asia. And then, that got canceled quite a while ago, though. So,
singer-composer Mac DeMarco says the Chinese cancellation was just the beginning.
We've had to cancel a couple other things, too. I've had a lot of friends cancel shows.
DeMarco worries about the impact on less well-known acts, especially after the cancellation of more festivals, including Austin's South by Southwest. There were 2,000 musical acts scheduled to perform this year, and the festival has already laid off a third of its workforce.
Luckily for us monetarily, it's like, I think we'll be okay, you know? But it's crazy to watch, you know, other musicians and bands, especially with like things like South by. It's like, people like scrape the money together to like fly out there from all over the world. It's a lot of people are bummed. I had a friend that had to come home from Europe a couple days ago. A couple friends went home to Australia. They were just starting a gigantic tour. It's like, there was a guy doing a music video here. He's leaving today. It sucks.
And then what about actually recording?
This is kind of what I do all the time anyway. I never really leave my garage, kind of always just in there recording. So, you know, I hate to say it, but kind of works for me.
Hard to dream in the light of day. Hard to hide from what they say.
For country star and Grammy winner Shelby Lynn, this period is as confusing for her as it is for the rest of us.
I guess we're going to have to wait. We're going to have to wait and see. I don't think anybody knows what the hell we're going to do right now.
Her new album, titled simply Shelby Lynn, is slated for release on April 17th, but she's not sure when she'll be able to hit the road and promote it.
From an economics perspective, when you're managing and thinking of your year, how much of a disruption is this for you?
I mean, I can't sit around and worry about things I can't control. And I think it's just a time for us to be reflective and maybe look at things a little differently. Instead of having somewhere to run around and be all crazy all the time, maybe we're not supposed to. Maybe we're supposed to just chill. And I know
deep in my heart. But even those who are worried about what happens in the short term believe music will play a necessary role in getting us all through this.
Ultimately, we do see this as finite. And whilst we don't think that the world will quite be the same again or as we knew it, we do think that people are going to want music. And already we're having people hit us up all the time. What are your playlists? What are you listening to? I need something to keep me positive. And I think music is a great unifier. And this virus is the great equalizer. You know, we're all in the same boat. So hoping that our artists can find some sense of purpose in being able to inspire and keep people's day-to-day upbeat.
For now, fans looking for inspiration from live music will be looking almost exclusively online.
Stop, yeah, please, before it's gone too far.
Finally tonight, actor-singer Kenny Rogers, the Grammy Award-winning artist, died yesterday. Rogers had jazz, folk, country, and pop hits, but was best known for The Gambler, with the refrain, you gotta know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em. Kenny Rogers was 81. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
When it comes to wireless, Consumer Cellular gives its customers the choice. Our no-contract plans give you as much or as little talk, text, and data as you want. And our U.S.-based customer service team is on hand to help. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.